Good morning. I'm Marcy Goldblum. May it please the court, counsel. This is not a sentencing case. This is, in fact, a Social Security disability case. And oddly enough, what I'd like to do in this case is start at the end. I'd like to start with step five. In these cases, once the claimant shows that they are unable to perform their past relevant work, the burden shifts to the commissioner to come forward with substantial evidence of other jobs the individual can do despite their impairments. Now, in this case, the ALJ found that Ms. McCleskey could do light work without the use of arms above shoulder height and no more than occasional use of the hands. And she found that based on vocational expert testimony, there were two jobs, the jobs of surveillance system monitor and telemarketer. The other jobs, the light jobs that had been mentioned, general office clerk and receptionist, were both not only semi-skilled jobs, but were ruled out because of more than occasional use of the hand. And that's pursuant to the vocational expert's testimony at page 391 of the record. Now, after the hearing, Ms. McCleskey's attorney at the time, Attorney Borowski, sent a letter to the judge and set out for her that there were some difficulties with the remaining jobs, with the jobs of telephone solicitor and surveillance system monitor. She pointed out that the telephone solicitor job was also a semi-skilled job, and it also required frequent use of the hands, of the fingers, rather. Now, what's important about these jobs being semi-skilled is that the claimant was found unable to perform her past relevant work, and the judge did not obtain any testimony about whether she had transferable work skills. Now, so we're left with these two jobs, telephone solicitor and surveillance system monitor. It was made apparent to the judge post-hearing. Now, and to keep in mind, the defendant argued that somehow the hearing attorney was too late in submitting her letter to the judge, when in fact the hearing was held December 6, 2005. Ms. Borowski sent her letter to the judge December 30, 2005. The judge didn't issue her decision until January 26, 2007. So she had plenty of time to review that. And in fact, the judge's decision makes it clear that she did consider Ms. Borowski's letter. Because she says, this, the administrative law judge says on page 32 of her decision, of the record, she says, talking about the surveillance system monitoring job, which Ms. Borowski had indicated was actually not an unskilled job but a semi-skilled one, she says, even assuming most of the surveillance system jobs would be affected, there remains a significant number of jobs in the economy. Well, the problem is she doesn't say what those jobs are. Now, we can assume that it must be referring to the telephone solicitor jobs because those are the only jobs that are left. But it's been made clear that those jobs aren't appropriate. They're both not only because it's semi-skilled and there's no evidence that this woman is able to do semi-skilled work, but also because the job requires frequent use of the fingers, which is part of the hands. So for the judge to find at step five that there, quote, remains a significant number of jobs in the economy, she hasn't met her burden of coming forth with substantial evidence of other jobs this individual could do despite her impairments. And I think that that's very significant because even if we are to assume that the judge's RFC finding was not marred by legal error, which we'll get to later, but even assuming that her RFC is correct, her step five findings are not supported by substantial evidence, and it's the commissioner's burden at that step, so the case must be remanded so to see if there are jobs at the sedentary level, because the vocational expert indicated that at the light level, with that hypothetical requiring no use of the arms above shoulder height and no more than occasional use of the hands, she wasn't able to come up with other light jobs. And at the sedentary level, typically there's greater requirement for good use of the hands, but we don't have that information in front of us. At step five, it's the commissioner's burden, and we have no evidence here that the commissioner met that burden. Now, one of the other problems in this case is that the judge's credibility determination, I think, suffers from some of the same problems that this court pointed out in Parker and in King. The judge's decision says, and this is page 29 of the record, it starts out and says...
Well, the government argues that with regard to the surveillance system monitor position, you don't need to use your hands. You don't even need to have hands.
Well, I beg to differ that you don't.
So the government says certainly as to the surveillance system monitor position, there was no reversible error.
Well, here's the problem with that. That's not necessarily consistent with what the judge found. Because Judge Dougherty, on page 32, in the second to last paragraph of discussing it's under finding 10. She says, even assuming that most of the surveillance system jobs would be affected.
Now, wait, where are you reading?
It's page 32 of the transcript.
No, I have the page, but what paragraph?
It's towards the last sentence of the second to last paragraph. It starts out with, although this assertion seems to paint with a broad brush.
Right.
She says, as there is no indication for this requirement literally applying to every job. But even assuming that most of the surveillance system's jobs would be affected,
because they need training, they need a certificate from the Department of Homeland Security.
Right, and the indication is that they aren't unskilled jobs, that they're semi-skilled jobs. So whether or not she needs a certificate, the indication is, and what it seems like from what the judge is saying in her actual opinion, is she's saying, okay, you may be painting with too broad a brush, but even assuming that this affects most of the surveillance system jobs, there's still a significant number of jobs in the economy.
And that's the telemarketing job.
And that's the telemarketer job. Well, there's no question that the telemarketer job, that is a semi-skilled job.
Why is that? Because you're using a phone, you're dialing a phone, or you're...
Well, it's the Dictionary of Occupational Titles says that it's semi-skilled, and I think
what does a telemarketer do?
Well, I think what they talk about telephone solicitor, and I think it has to do more with the fact that there's data entry on a computer system when they're either entering orders or reviewing
So you're saying a telephone solicitor doesn't just pick up the phone and give a spiel, but that depending on what the person he's calling says, has to make an entry? Is that what you're saying?
According to what the Dictionary of Occupational Titles informs us, there is more to it than just being on the headset and talking to folks on the phone. And that's what bumps it up from the unskilled level to the semi-skilled level. And that is a...
The question wasn't so much the skill level as intensive use of hands.
Well, they're both important. But if we assume, based on what the judge has found herself, that she can't do her past work, the judge didn't ask the vocational expert about the transferability of skills, so we can't assume that there are any transferability of skills. The judge also didn't...
A skilled job that didn't require hands?
Excuse me?
Couldn't she do a skilled job that didn't require the use of hands?
If she had the skills that transferred to that job, sure.
Well,
but we don't know.
She has worked in the past.
But we don't know if she has skills that transfer to these particular jobs. That's a vocational question.
What kind of education does she have?
You know, she has a GED. And she got the GED, I believe, in 1979 or 1980. But transferability of skills is a very specific question to the commissioner's guidelines. And it's a question for a vocational expert. I mean, what I might think might be a transferable skill, what the court may think might be a transferable skill, might not be considered one by the vocational expert. So that's why it's important. At any rate...
So you're saying that really the only job the administrative law judge has identified for her is the telemarketing.
That's correct, and that is inappropriate because it doesn't meet with the guidelines. I would briefly also say that the ALJ does include the stock credibility language that this court rejected in terms of not being entirely credible that was noted in the Parker and Ken cases. But if the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Goldblum. Mr. Duarte?
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, since counsel focused her argument on the Step 5 issue, that's where I will begin. Counsel's argument misses a significant point, which is that the alleged conflicts with the DOT, between V's testimony and the DOT, were not raised at the hearing. And that is the crux of the issue. That's the fundamental point here. The ALJ did kind of
bring it all down to the telemarketing job.
Well, actually, he didn't, Your Honor. I think if we look at the language that was quoted, the ALJ, first of all, distinguished the opinion from this extra record vocational expert that was hired by plaintiff's counsel. He said, basically, there's no basis for this opinion. He says, but then even assuming that it does merit some consideration, there are these other jobs. So he didn't rely simply on the telemarketer position. There's nothing to say that he accepted.
It looks like that to me. It's not as if he said, well, these security guards don't need this permission from DHS. She didn't say that. She didn't question this proposition. She said it didn't matter because there's still the telemarketing.
Well, Your Honor, I read it differently. When I think when she writes that, although this assertion...
I think it can be read differently because she's not questioning this proposition.
Well, Your Honor, my interpretation is that she is questioning the proposition. She's saying that the assertion paints with a broad brush. There's no indication that this requirement literally applies to every job. And then she qualifies as she gives them some
she's not
the benefit
saying
of the doubt.
It doesn't apply to every job. She has no idea. She doesn't know what this. She doesn't know anything about this. What this Department of Homeland Security Act requires.
And that's the problem with this whole procedure, Your Honor, is that plaintiff.
Well, why didn't she find out what you know? Look. There is a problem with this telemarketing job, so why shouldn't she do some research and see whether it's true that every electronic surveillance job requires the permission of DHS? Seems a little odd, but who knows?
Well, Your Honor, simply because she's not required to. There's nothing in the regulations.
If she doesn't do that, she doesn't have any idea whether this person can perform any job.
No, Your Honor, because this information came by outside of the process. The way
where it came from, she accepts that it's possible. It's not that she says this is untimely or this is ridiculous or, you know, I don't believe it. She doesn't say anything like that. She says it doesn't matter because there are these other jobs, but the only other jobs are the telemarketing jobs. So if the applicant can't perform those telemarketing jobs, then she's disabled.
Well, the information about the telemarketing jobs also came outside of the process, Your Honor. That's the fundamental problem here, is that there are regulations that set forth how this process is going to work. And those procedures do not allow for post-hearing argument to be submitted and considered by the ALJ outside the process.
The problem is the ALJ didn't make that specific finding, right? The ALJ didn't make that specific finding. These are outside the process, therefore I reject them.
No, she did not.
That's not in there. She considered it. She considered the whole problem of getting the clearance from Homeland Security. So she took it into account. So maybe she shouldn't have done it, but now that it's in the game and it was something she considered, isn't that something we can examine?
Your Honor, I don't think so, because the problem is that, you know, the ALJ shouldn't be forced to navigate this course between the...
She wasn't forced to do anything. She decided it didn't matter, so she was not going to bother with it. She didn't say, this is improper, I won't consider it, it's too late. She didn't say anything like that. She seems to think that telemarketing... Look, that's in the previous paragraph. The only jobs identified for her, for the applicant, by this vocational expert was surveillance system monitor and telemarketer. If you drop out the surveillance system monitor, you're left with the telemarketer.
That is correct that that's what it says, Your Honor, but I don't believe that she dropped out the surveillance
anyway,
system
you
monitor.
Made the you made exactly the same point that she did. You said it didn't matter.
Judge, I think we're resting on the fact that the surveillance system monitor position still exists, because that is that doesn't require reaching or handling.
Pardon?
And
what?
Our position is that the surveillance system monitor position is the viable position, Your Honor, and not the telemarketer position. I think it's actually the reverse of what plaintiff is arguing.
That's only if she can get this certificate from DHS, right?
No, Your Honor, because under the DOT identifies the surveillance system monitor as unskilled in an SVP of 2. This information came from some other resource, and under Overman and the rulings and the regulations, all the ALJ is required to do is consider any conflicts between
yes,
the VE's testimony.
The ALJ goes beyond what she's required to do. Is that impermissible? And we're not supposed to, and we can't, she can't do that? She's forbidden to do that, or what?
Well, there's not. The problem is that we're uncharted waters here, Judge, and that what we have here is a situation where plaintiffs, you know, the way these hearings work is set up very clearly in the regulations, and they understand that the ALJ has the burden at step 5. They know there's going to be a VE who's going to be testifying at the hearing. They know there's going to be a hearing, and it is to their it behooves them to come to that hearing prepared and cross-examine the VE and put the ALJ through her paces and make her carry that step 5 burden.
So you've got a Chenery problem because you're defending the administrative decision on a ground that the administrator didn't use. The ALJ didn't say this came too late. You're saying it comes too late. You're not supposed to do that.
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ shouldn't be prejudiced by the fact that she considered this evidence that comes from outside the process. Mm-hmm. Based on what she's required to do under the rulings and Overman and the regulations, she acted properly. The fact that she took in this other consideration that was where the plaintiff leveraged her failure to cross-examine and do what she should have done during the hearing and comes back after the hearing to say, oh, well, now I have objections, that shouldn't prejudice the ALJ. The ALJ did what she was required to do under the hearings and under the regulations.
Yeah, but here's what the ALJ said. She said, although this assertion seems to paint with a broad brush, as there is no indication that this requirement, referring to this card, literally applies to every job, even assuming most of the surveillance jobs would be affected, and there's no evidence of that, there remain a significant number of jobs in the economy. But I know she, the thing is there was no evidence beyond this letter that she accepted, the letter saying that you needed to pass this requirement. So, how does she make the leap that it's either not required or it's irrelevant or the remaining significant, that it only applies to some portion of the surveillance jobs, not other portions? I mean, she's uninformed, isn't she?
She is, but I think that what she's doing here, Your Honor, is for the sake of argument, accepting the letter. But I think at the same time, she's indicating this has no basis. This letter doesn't tell me anything about this specific position. But even if I do credit it, I still have the telemarketer position.
But you're adding a lot of words that she didn't.
You sure are.
These are not her words.
Yeah.
Those words aren't in there.
Well, those exact words aren't in there, but I think, Your Honor, it's telegraphed from her use of the language that although this assertion seems to paint with a broad brush.
Anyway, there's no rule that the ALJ can't consider evidence submitted after the hearing. That doesn't make any sense.
But there isn't a rule that says they can't, but there isn't a rule that says that they have to.
Right.
Of course not, but evidence is submitted. She did consider it. And she said it didn't make any difference. That's very different from saying, I won't consider this evidence because it's too late. Instead, she says, I consider the evidence, I'm skeptical about it, but I don't have to make a judgment about its probative value because it's irrelevant, since she still has the telemarketing. If she's wrong about that, and this person can't do telemarketing, then there's no basis for her decision.
Well, Your Honor, the problem with this is that...
You're making arguments. You're violating the Chenery principle. You're making all sorts of arguments that are not in the not the administrator's arguments. About the impropriety of this late evidence and so on. Everything has to come in at the hearing and all that. She didn't say any of those things.
Yeah, I agree. The ALJ didn't say any of those things. I think the problem here, then, is that plaintiffs have found a way to manipulate the process, or by the gut Overman.
Understand all that
and
manipulation. Look, we're constantly getting letters after oral argument. People say, look, I thought of something, or I misspoke at the argument, and I want to correct it, and so on. And we don't say, oh, you're manipulating the process. We don't say that. Why should she say that?
When the issue that we have here, then, is that under the rulings and the regulations, the ALJ is concerned with conflicts between the VE's testimony and the DOT raised during the hearing. That's the standard that they have to meet. That is part of their burden. Now we have a situation where plaintiffs are coming in with extra record evidence after the fact.
Plaintiffs are coming in. Is this some abuse that's going on?
Claimants. I apologize. I used the wrong term.
I mean, you go so far out of what you're supposed to be saying, right? Plaintiffs, is some big abuse of the system that's going on? Is that what you want us to think?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is that you mentioned we're in uncharted territory. There's no ruling that says they can't deal with this. There's nothing that says they have to.
The problem is they get, as I said, it took more than a year for the ALJ to write her decision. So she gets some information that, oh, by the way, this electronic surveillance sounded like a great job. You don't need arms. You know, terrific job, perfect job. For the Social Security Administration, don't need legs for that matter. All you need is eyes. But then there's this wrinkle. There's this Department of Homeland Security. Maybe they don't allow people like this to be electronic. What's the administrative law judge supposed to do? Just say, well, I don't care. You know, it's too late. Should have put it in earlier. To hell with you. That wouldn't be very responsible government response, would it?
Well, Your Honor, the problem that the ALJ has to answer the first part of your question is that their conduct, they are guided by what is in the regulations and the rulings. That is how they know how they're supposed to treat claims, what they have to do.
So, in other words, you're saying she disobeyed the regulation.
No, Your Honor, there's no...
She shouldn't have said anything about this letter she got.
Well, Your Honor, it certainly seems that standing here today, she would have been better off not having mentioned it at all. Mm-hmm. There is no regulation that requires her to do it. As we discussed, there's nothing that said that she couldn't. The point is that this puts her in to sail between the Scylla of having to comply with Overman and the conflicts between the DOT and the VE and the Charybdis of having to now deal with conflicts from unknown vocational sources. And to navigate that narrow course is not something that's set forth in the regulations and the rulings. According to the regulations and the rulings, their concern is only with potential conflicts between the DOT and the VE's testimony.
Unknown vocational source.
Who is it?
Yes.
It is someone who's nobody.
Someone who doesn't.
I don't know who they are. I don't know
business.
Their background, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I don't know their background.
It says from another vocational expert in another case. That sounds like a legitimate person, doesn't it?
It sounds like it, Judge, but it's just a letter submitted by claimant. We don't know the basis. That's why
it
happened at the hearing.
She describes it. She, the administrative law, is it a she or a he? I'm getting the sexes confused. Anyway, the representative presented a letter from another vocational expert in another case. That sounds like a reputable communication. You have to be qualified as a vocational expert. You don't just come in and start giving, right? You have to be certified, don't you, as a vocational expert?
Presumption, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I think that's a reasonable presumption.
So, in other words, someone who's certified as a vocational expert writes a letter saying, oh, by the way, you know, you've got DHS involved in this. What makes you think this is some kind of phony?
I didn't say there was anything illegitimate about the
Certainly
the
made
opinion.
It sounded that way.
No, the problem is that the ALJ...
Some unknown vocational source, some kibitzer comes in and starts mucking up the works.
just because somebody is unknown, Your Honor, doesn't mean that they're illegitimate. The point was that the ALJ, according to the regulations and rulings, has a set of standards that she's supposed to follow and that she knows she's supposed to follow. All of a sudden, when something comes in from the outside of the record, and
this is a kind of parody of bureaucratic blindness, right? You have another vocational expert writes in and says, you know, there's a problem here. And she says, she accepts the possibility that is a problem, but then she thinks it's irrelevant. And then, you have, that's fine, and you have a question whether she really was able to dispose of it in that fashion. She could have said, I suppose, I don't have to consider this, but she didn't say that, so. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Duarte. Your time's expired.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Goldblum, you have 1 minute if you have anything further.
I just want to touch on a couple of things. Mr. Pagella, who wrote the letter, is indeed another vocational expert on Social Security's panel of experts who appears at these hearings. Second of all, there is nothing outside the procedures that normally go on. Particularly, this hearing was 5 years ago, and what happened is that the vocational experts will testify. As the attorney going in, you try to prepare as much as you can, but you have no idea what jobs they're going to come up with. And particularly 5 years ago, less attorneys had their laptops that had the DOT on it, so it was very typical. And in this case, as you'll see on page 398 of the record, Ms. Borowski asked the judge, can I submit something after the hearing? And the judge said, I'm not going to hold the record open, but if you want to submit it, go ahead. And then she says, in all probability, it, meaning the decision, isn't going to come out before January anyhow. Now, that was December, and she was talking, we think, about January 2006. In fact, the decision didn't come out until January of 2007, and this post-hearing letter with all the information was submitted less than 30 days after the hearing. So there was nothing outside the standard procedures. It happens on a very frequent basis.
That's just what I was going to ask you. You're an experienced counsel in this area, and I recognize that, and very able. But how often does this occur, this submission post the theoretical close of the record?
Probably at least 15 to 20% of the cases.
There's a post-hearing submission?
Yes. For one reason or another. Thank you, Your Honors. And I would just ask that, based on everything that's been in front of this court, that the case be remanded.
Okay. Thank you very much to Ms. Goldblum and Mr. Duarte. And the court will be in a recess until Monday.